This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak with Hollywood talent agent Paul Allen Smith and his friend, director and movie actor Carl Weathers, about a remarkable book called Pen Pal, Prison Letters from a Free Spirit on Slow Death Row, by Teo Atala Salah L. We speak with one of the great journalists in America, Chris Hedges. We're speaking with Chris about the impending election and what's in the back of everybody's minds, what's going to happen after the election. Is fascism on the horizon, and how we can stop it.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
Teo Atala Salah L. died in 2018 on slow death row while serving a life sentence in a Pennsylvania prison. He was a man with a dizzying array of talents and vocations: author, scholar, teacher, musician, and activist. He was the founder of the Coalition for the Abolition of Prisons. He was also an extraordinarily eloquent correspondent. Today, we're going to talk with his friend, the Hollywood agent Paul Allen Smith, about the letters that Smith exchanged with Teo, which were written over a decade and a half. We'll also speak with Paul's friend, the actor and director Carl Weathers, who read the letters for the audiobook. The book is called Pen Pal, Prison Letters from a Free Spirit on Slow Death Row. It has a preface by Mike Africa Jr. Paul Allen Smith and Carl Weathers, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Michael.
Thanks for asking us.
Before he passed, Teo wrote 568 letters to Paul Allen Smith. 92 of them are in the book Pen Pal, Prison Letters from a Free Spirit on Slow Death Row. Carl Weathers, might you please read the letter that Teo wrote to Paul on May 14th of 2004?
May 14th, 2004. Dear Paul, welcome home from your first vacation in years. I'm glad to learn that you're well-rested, eating and sleeping better, and enjoying the solitude and freedom from courtship of a female. It's good that you've made time for yourself, and to slow down and nurture calmness, and to make room for new ways of seeing old problems. After all, no one is living your life for you, and no one cares for you, or should replace the care you give yourself. The tardiness of my response to your letter is due to the two-day lockdown and the searching of cells by the black-uniformed SWAT guards. We were strip-searched and cuffed to the cell doors as they trashed the cells. I keep a neat, clean cage, e.g. my books, clothes, toilet articles, pictures, letters, papers, pens, tablets, etc., organized. I am listed as a political, educated troublemaker. They smiled and laughed as they ransacked my things. One guard attempted to bait me by asking the other guard, "What do you call a black man who has undergraduate and graduate degrees?" The other guard said, "A smart nigger." During the past 28 years of incarceration, I've learned the value of differentiating between reacting and responding to the pain of prisons. I've had to learn how to handle myself under all kinds of stressful conditions. In my view, the issue of self-control is central to coping with the problems and pain of prisons. I've captured something positive about the human spirit's ability to come to grips with what is most difficult in life, and to find within it room to grow in strength and wisdom. For me, facing the full demeaning punishment of prison means finding and coming to terms with what is most in me. There's not one person on the planet who does not have his or her own version of pain and problems. I do not mean total disaster. Rather, it means the poignant enormity of our life experience. It includes crisis and disaster, but also all the little things that go wrong and that add up. It reminds me that life is always in flux, that everything we think is permanent is actually only temporary and constantly changing. This includes our ideas, our opinions, our relationships, our jobs, our possessions, our creations, our bodies, everything. I refuse to allow racist guards and the corrupt criminal justice system to rob me of my self-determination and self-empowerment, or my hope and spirit. In my view, the storms of life will strengthen us as they teach us growing and healing in the world of flux and change, and sometimes great pain. I've learned to see myself and the world in new ways, and to work in new ways with thoughts and feelings and perceptions, and to laugh at all things a little more, including myself, as I practice finding the main and maintaining my balance as best I can. See enclosed cartoons and related material. In short, I feel more in control, even in these stressful situations that previously would have sent me spinning out of control. I am handling the entire range of life experience, including my much sought after death by the criminal justice system, much more skillfully. The pain has not stopped, but my attitude toward the prison, pain of prison, has changed a lot. It was Howard Zinn who helped me to get in touch with my inner strength, and his believing in me and not giving up on me and teaching me the tools for making such a huge transformation in my life. It has been over 20 years since I met Howard. He not only guided and inspired me and helped me earn an MA in political science, he came to this prison to visit me. We hugged, laughed, and talked about many things. He wrote about our visit in one of his books, You Can't Be Neutral on a Moving Train. He worked magic on my mind. He's a very special human being, and I love him very much. Gee whiz, so far this letter has become a written catharsis for me. I guess I'm trying to convey that although it's been a rough and tough week for me, I want you to understand that in my heart of hearts, there is joy as well as suffering, hope as well as despair, calm as well as agitation, and incessant love. Enclosed is the first of my many gifts to you. It is a negative of Howard and me and my Quaker friends who guided him here. You can now see your lifelong friends, viz. Howard Zinn and Tio, a motley bunch of older guys, if there ever was one. I'll always stay in touch. I tend to make lifelong friendships. Stay tuned. Warm hugs and much love. Tio Atala Salael.
Thank you, Carl Weathers, for reading one of Tio's letters. I'd like to ask both of you to talk about Tio's accomplishments. He spent 40 years in prison, died 2 years ago. Paul, why don't you go first?
Carl, great reading. You bring Tio back to life, which is a surreal circumstance for me each time I listen. It's just amazing. Let me get to Tio's accomplishments briefly. I mean, there's so many. I'm going to just kind of share some right off the top of my head. You know, Tio started an organization called the Coalition to Abolish Prisons, which he called CAP, back in 95, way before its resurgence in 2000. Additionally, he started a GED program in the prison, and it was so successful that the guards and the wardens turned away from it, because technically it was illegal. Peer-to-peer education, while extremely effective, as we proved, Tio proved, but I got to oversee it, proved that these guys excelled by learning from each other. If you're a pretty tough guy in his 20s and can't read, you're pretty embarrassed. But to have someone, an elder, if you will, who is in your shoes, empathize, and to the point of saying, look, I was like you, that breakthrough is much more prevalent than if you have some guy like me coming into a prison. Tio also organized bands to perform for everybody in the prison and recruited musicians, and he wrote the music. Of course, as he said, as Carl mentioned, wrote in the letter, he tended to make really lifelong friends and was an extraordinary and prolific writer to his friends and also writing op-ed pieces. Howard Zinn and his brother published an autobiography that he wrote, and let alone he indirectly provided the material to make this book. So there you have it. It can go on. I'm gonna let you ask the next question.
Well, Carl, did you want to add to that?
No, there's you know, I think Paul really listed a number of the accomplishments, but I think on top of all that, maybe without necessarily intending to, I think T.O., through the letters and through the communication with the various people that he knew, and I don't know the details nearly as intimately as Paul does, but he touched a lot of people, it seems. And when one first reads these letters, you know, I had the good privilege through Paul of seeing these letters, or at least a number of them, the growth and the intimacy of their relationship, two men, two human beings from really very different backgrounds who met, and over those years, Paul can tell you exactly how many years, but through all those years, not only developed a friendship, but maintained it. And that to me is remarkable because, you know, we're walking around on the street, and how many of us do that so consistently with people we've met and that we call friends? So I think touching people, and hopefully through this book, you will touch so many more.
Carl, like most of us, you first became aware of T.O. from reading his letters. What was your takeaway? Has T.O.'s point of view affected you in a manner that perhaps you may not have been affected previously, and especially during these unique times?
Wow, very good question. There is in his writing a kind of poetry. It's very personal. There's artistry in his writing. And again, to start out in the beginning, Paul, you have to answer, how many years was it that you two got to know each other over the span of time, as soon as I finish answering this question? But to initially read them, they are moving, and they touch you in a particular way because this man was an individual but still a part of the community at large. But over a period of time in reading them, you see his growth and his vulnerability as he allows himself to open more and more to Paul. So at this particular time, they're a pretty strong testament and statement about the direction in which we might want to go as human beings who seem to be really gravitating towards strife all the time. And here's a guy who is, it seems to me, doing the opposite.
That's great. 14 years we were in touch consistently. You can also then add 3 years to we're still in touch, but on a more ethereal level.
How'd you meet T.O., Paul? Please talk about that and what it was like when you first visited him.
Well, first of all, to answer the question, how we met was through Howard Zinn, who was, by all estimations, another very close friend of mine. And when I discovered that Howard was writing to prisoners, you have to understand that Howard and I were very competitive. Howard, even though he sold millions of copies of his books and was internationally renowned, I still wanted to be better than him in everything. So when I discovered that he had a pen pal, I said, well, if you have a pen pal, then I need a pen pal. He said, so that's how it started. And he said, well, okay. And if you read the first email from Howard, you're going to get a really good sense of our relationship. It was 90% just screwing around with each other, and I missed that dearly. So there you go, and to answer your other part, when I visited Tio, it was somewhat reminiscent of how it is at most prisons. You know, you go through these various machinations, but they were pretty good to us. I can't say how they are with others, but I think they knew there's this guy coming, you know, and like anything that you see today, if they look at me and they go, oh, we better be nice to him because he understands the laws and the rules, so let's be polite. And they were very, very good to the two of us, and very respectful of Tio. But remember, at that time, Tio had earned the respect of every warden, and that's another subject to go off on, and you can learn about that, how he earned their respect. He had, in addition to the wardens and the guards, not always, I don't want to suggest they all bowed down to him, but there was this reticence of respect. And then at the same time, he had the respect of most, if not all, the prisoners.
Can I jump on that, too? Because it's interesting to me of how many years ago I read the People's History of the United States, written by the great Howard Zinn. And I really didn't really know a lot about Howard Zinn at that time. Not that I know that much about him now, but since then, of course, you know, Howard Zinn is a part of, good God, he's a part of America, you know, the wholeness of America. And it's interesting to me that Tio was a friend and a really good friend with Howard, and was also and still remains to be a really good friend postmortem of Paul's. And I then meet Paul years ago, and so Tio's reach, if you will, is pretty great and pretty strong. And if we allow it, how many more can he reach through these letters? To me, that's really remarkable in a man's legacy and in a man's life. So there's another reason to be a part of this, just because I admire what he seemed to be searching for in his life.
We're speaking with Carl Weathers, who is a Hollywood actor and director, and his friend Paul Allen Smith, who is a Hollywood agent. Paul Allen Smith has come out with a book of Tio Atala Salael's letters, a number of letters, 92 of them. They're in the book Pen Pal, Prison Letters from a Free Spirit on Slow Death Row by Tio Atala Salael. Carl, how did you get involved with this project? How did you meet Paul? What was it that led you to doing the audiobook for Pen Pal?
Well, this is several questions. I'll try to be brief. First of all, I met Paul years ago, and I don't even know how I was led to meet Paul, but we met years ago, and have been involved over the years now. So, that existed, and then Paul told me that he was writing this book, and okay, what's it about? And told me briefly, and then mentioned T.O., and I said, I'd love to read some of these letters, if that's okay. And Paul said, sure. He's pretty open, most of the time anyway. And I started reading the letters, and I found them really remarkable because of, again, the language, the poetry in them, the vulnerability in them. There was something about the way T.O. expressed himself and what he was expressing that really touched me. And the more I read, the more I really liked what I was reading. And I said, you know, to Paul, you know, I think I said this, but I knew I asked if these were recorded, if I could read Tio, because I found them that moving. And Paul said, well, why not? You know, and that's how it happened. And here we are now. And, I guess the audio part of this project is completed, and we're getting a chance to talk to you, Michael, and to let people know how great Tio was and how remarkable this relationship was with he and Paul Allen Smith. And I just have the good fortune to tag along. So that's kind of it in a nutshell.
Well, we're all grateful that you tagged along, Carl. Might you now read a second letter, perhaps the September 7th, 2005 letter? Could you read that for us?
Oh, absolutely. I'd love to. September 7, 2005. Dear Pablo, stayed up all damn night, all last night, until I regained better control of myself. Yesterday, while talking to you via the phone, I broke down. It was the first time during the 30 years of being incarcerated that my emotions got the best of me. It was the first time for Joe Saman to witness my weakness. This morning he came by this cage and checked on me. I thanked him, told him I'm okay. We shook hands, smiled at each other, and wished each other well. It just so happens that this cage is located near his office. He has a lot of power at this prison. He is the unit manager in charge of approximately 400 prisoners, 4 counselors, 20 guards, and 2 female seccis. He has the power to move, transfer, and place prisoners in the hole. When he became aware that this staff member called me a nigger convict, he called me to his office to discuss the matter because he assumed I would attack the staff person. Word reached him that the staff person was informed that I was preparing to confront and become physically involved with the staff member. Joe told me to hold on and not say or do anything until he investigated the situation and got back to me. He suggested I stay in this cage until he checked things out. In sum, I took his advice, plus did a lot of personal soul-searching. My main crew members and all our students were going to get involved physically if the guards came after me. As time and days passed, I cooled down. I realized it would have been impossible to win fighting the guards. Nor did I want my crew or my students to risk their lives and lose the chance to make parole and be released from this hellhole. I bit the bullet, and we were better off reorganizing in a positive way. They are unaware that yesterday I broke down. Long ago, I had hopes of talking with you, teasing the hell out of you, giving you a hard time, and making you laugh and happy. The voice you listened to was not the normal sound of my voice. With tears running down my face, nose running, and unable to speak clearly, my introduction to you was a disaster. I implore your understanding. In the future, you will hear my voice at its very best. You heard me when I was weak. I want you to hear me when I'm strong and in control of myself. I have the courage and confidence in myself to admit to my mistakes and when I mess up and admit to you that I'm not the assumed strong person people think I am. However, I always try to recover and rebuild what I may have lost. I have opened up to you, stripped myself bare to the bones, and allowed you to see and learn about the inner me, my emotions, pain, and hurt. No holding back. I've not been this upfront with Howard, whom you know I truly love and respect. You have become my sole outlet for my true emotions. Living in this prison for 30 years has taken a toll on my mind, body, and soul. Yet my spirit grows ever stronger. It's a strange inner feeling that drives me not to give up without trying to make a strong comeback. During past years, I've witnessed men self-destruct, hang up, jump off the top range to their death. Others have died in their sleep, others waiting and wanting to die, walking around in the daze. It's sad and tragic. I refuse to stop trying to become a better person. Thank you very much for understanding, Tio. Hope your hip and knee are healing well. Let me know when you're fully recovered because I'll race you to the length of the pool. Next time, I'll read my thoughts about Bush and the slow-ass response to the hurricane that hit the Gulf Coast. Stay tuned.
We're speaking with Carl Weathers and Paul Allen Smith about the just-published book, Pen Pal, Prison Letters from a Free Spirit on Slow Death Row. Paul, how can our listeners get a hold of a copy of this book?
Well, you go to the following website, orbooks.com, or orbooks.com. You'll see an extraordinary cover, which I wish I could take credit for, but alas, Colin Robinson did an amazing job designing it along with his crew. It's just a gorgeous cover, I have to say.
Yeah. It struck me because the bars are actually pens, if you look closely. Who gets the profits from this book, Paul?
Well, they don't. I've learned this from them. They don't call it profits, although in our business they certainly do. They call them royalties, and the royalties to the book go to the W.E.B. Du Bois Library in Massachusetts, where not only Tio's articles and letters and the like are stored formally by a wonderful woman. There's a whole team there, but Carolyn White has been incredible to us, thanks in part to Lois Ahrens. Lois Ahrens was the one who introduced them to Tio. Lois runs realcostofprisons.org. She's an amazing activist and was an extraordinary pen pal on her own to Tio. Anyway, going back to Orr Books, that all our royalties from them will go to this part of the W.E.B. Du Bois Center, where they digitize and preserve other folks, important folks, Americans, and the like, just like Tio.
Paul, we're running out of our allotted time, unfortunately, and I wanted to ask you, what kind of support are you getting to help publicize Pen Pal? I saw that Harry Belafonte said the book is remarkable, and a number of people have checked in on it. Is the word getting out?
Well, the book was just released. We hope so. I mean, we have people like Harry. We have wonderful activists like Connie Rice. And the wonderful journalist who writes for The Nation, Dave Zirin's been very supportive. Even the Dick Wolf, who runs the Law and Order franchise, the Chicago franchise, has been supportive of it. We have a handful of others. The man who writes many films named Paul Laverty has been incredibly helpful. It goes on and on. Then you have people like Carl. I mean, Carl's really influential, you know. Carl is, in addition to directing The Mandalorian on Disney Plus, he's one of the stars. So that helps. And we, of course, have hired a publicist, a wonderful publicist named Tracy Harper, who runs Harper Public Relations. So, you know, we're doing our best, man, and we can't thank you enough for doing what you're doing. It's a huge help, you know. We want to get this. It's just an extraordinary read.
When I met you and when I read this book, I realized that this is a book that our listeners on Law & Disorder Radio are going to love. And I'm so grateful to have you, Paul Allen Smith, and you, Carl Weathers, on the show. I thank you very much, and I wish you all the best with the book, Pen Pal. You guys take it easy.
Thank you, Michael.
Ciao. Thanks for everything.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
We are living in extraordinary times. At the same time, we face both tremendous danger and extraordinary opportunity to its citizens. Our opportunity comes from the massive social mobilizations that we have not seen in 75 years. A young generation has risen up. White people are involved with black people who are providing leadership. Perhaps 20 million people have taken to the streets. Trump is desperate and resorts to stoking fear of violence, race-baiting, lying, explaining to his followers that all the unrest is due to agitators, Antifa, Marxists, and socialists. The Democratic Party has chosen to oppose Trump with Joe Biden. The best you can say about Biden is that he's not Trump. He has vowed to veto a Medicare for All bill if it comes across his desk. and he suggested that police violence could be curbed if they shot people in the legs, not in the chest. He's for giving police departments more money. The worst you can say about Biden and the Democratic Party is that they are not a bulwark against fascism. The big financial backers of the Democratic Party crushed the Sanders campaign, indicating they would rather have Trump than a social Democrat who would cost them money and raise expectations. Sanders, for his part, missed his historic moment twice when he refused to break from the Democratic Party in both 2016 and 2020. Instead, he performs the function of a sheepdog, herding people back into a moribund capitalist party that has nothing to offer as a way out of the combined crises of climate, the economy, race, health, and the escalating nuclear buildup. We speak today with return guest Chris Hedges about where we're at, how we got here, and what to do next. Chris Hedges is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. He was the foreign correspondent for the New York Times for 15 years and served as Middle Eastern bureau chief. He's the host of Emmy Award-nominated RT America show On Contact and the author of numerous books, including America, The Farewell Tour, Empire of Illusion, and American Fascists, The Christian Right and the War on America. Chris Hedges, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Michael.
Chris, Bertolt Brecht has written, quote, "How can anyone tell the truth about fascism unless he's willing to speak out against capitalism, which brings it forth? Those who are against fascism without being against capitalism, who lament only, are people who want to eat veal without slaughtering the calf," end quote. American neoliberal capitalism has held sway over the last 40 years, starting with Ronald Reagan. Chris, please talk about the USA as a disintegrating society.
Well, I would use Carl Polanyi's distinction of unfettered or unregulated capitalism as opposed to capitalism. Capitalism in any society is an insidious force. And how do we define capitalism? It is about the maximization of profit, no matter what you do, and the reduction of the cost of production, which is labor. Those are the twin goals of any capitalist enterprise. And when capitalism has no external controls, because it has no internal controls, then, in Polanyi's words, you create a mafia economy and a mafia state. And that's exactly what's happened in American society. Now, it's been a long process. It began by design in the early 1970s in reaction to the rise of popular movements in the 60s. And it was all laid out, and anyone can read it. It's the Powell Memo, 1971, written by Lewis Powell, who was the counsel for the Chamber of Commerce, later appointed to the Supreme Court. He actually singles out Ralph Nader by name. And it's about using corporate money to take control of not just democratic institutions, but cultural institutions, understanding that, as Gramsci, you know, wrote, cultural institutions are important forms of social control. And that process has been this kind of rolling or creeping corporate coup d'etat, turbocharged by the complete surrender of the Democratic Party under the Clinton administration, mirroring what Tony Blair did with the Labor Party, where they sold out the American working class, not to mention the working poor, to corporate power. And so you saw a series of moves by the Clinton administration, starting in 1994 with NAFTA, which was the greatest betrayal of the American working class since the 1947 Taft-Hartley Act, which makes it very difficult to organize and unionize and strike, the one weapon that workers have to push back against capital. The deregulation of the FCC, which is not a small move, because it consolidated the control of, in particular, the electronic media, but not exclusively the electronic media, into the hands of a half dozen corporations, Comcast, Viacom, General Electric, you know, reducing acceptable opinion in political debate to what Dorothy Parker used to say about Katharine Hepburn's emotional range, that it went from A to B. So, you know, remember, if you go back a couple years, the whole debate about Syria, well, do we bomb them or do we bomb them and put boots on the ground? Like, and I speak as the former Middle East bureau chief of the New York Times and a fierce opponent of these endless wars from the beginning. Like, those are the two things we have to debate. Clinton, of course, ripped down the firewalls between commercial and investment banks by destroying the 1933 Glass-Steagall Act, which was put up to prevent the kind of crash that took place in 1929 and that subsequently took place in 2007 and 8. Clinton, with his ally Joe Biden, and this again is an important component, militarized the police and exploded the prison population. Why? Well, because if your manufacturing goes to places like Monterrey, Mexico, that's where GM is, and towns like Anderson, Indiana, which used to be a huge manufacturing center where people had unionized jobs with benefits and is turned into a wasteland, which it is, and workers in Mexico are making $3 an hour without benefits, so you have whole segments of the working class, and of course the people who suffer most are always people of color first, in particular African Americans, then you need, if they're not integrated into the society, which in itself is a form of social control, as the sociologist Emile Durkheim points out, then you need other forms of social control, and that's lethal, unaccountable police forces that carry out reigns of terror. I don't think that's an exaggeration. In poor urban pockets, what Malcolm X called our internal colonies, and mass incarceration. All of this was done, or certainly the seeds of it were planted by the Reagan administration, but it was really pushed through in a massive way by the Democratic Party, by the Clinton administration. So what in essence it did is create unregulated capitalism. So Marx calls capitalism a revolutionary force in that sense that it will exploit unfettered, unregulated, uncontrolled. It will exploit everything. It turns everything into a commodity. The human beings become commodities. The natural world becomes a commodity that it exploits until exhaustion or collapse. So I would differ with Brecht only with that distinction. But we are certainly now living in an age when we all are forced, including the natural world, to kneel before the primacy of corporate profit, and often short-term corporate profit, at the expense of human life and the very ecosystem that sustains human life.
We're speaking with Chris Hedges. Chris, define fascism for us, particularly what's fascism American style?
So fascism has no coherent ideology. And if you look at the history of fascism, Italian fascism, for example, was very different from German fascism. Italian fascism never actually embraced the deep anti-Semitism of Germany. Its policies are completely contradictory because in the rise of the Nazi Party, like with the big strikes in Berlin, the Nazis allied with the communists. They used the word socialist because with the collapse of Weimar and the austerity program, pushed through by the centrist government of Ebert and others, you know, they had to cater to, after the crash, to the international banking system. So they actually, like, abolished, if you can imagine, with massive unemployment benefits or unemployment insurance to pay the banks. Fascism is an emotional, it's hyper-masculine, it caters to emotions. Because its ideology is really almost absurdist. And there's a book, by the way, called Male Fantasies by Klaus, I'll mispronounce his German name, but it's Theweleit, which is kind of brilliant, where he kind of seeks to discover the emotional core of fascism by looking at the Freikorps, which was the antecedents to the brown shirts and the mercenaries. But I think he's right in that it's an emotional, it appeals to an emotional void, perhaps, that is taking place within the society among disempowered people. It simplifies an understanding of a complex reality. So We see it in the United States. You know, why are you suffering? Well, it's because of 11 million undocumented workers who don't even earn minimum wage. It's ridiculous that that's why you've lost your job or your community is in free fall. But it works on an emotional level. It gives you targets. It relies on an alliance with the capitalist class, the great industrialists in Germany like Krupp and others who made fortunes under the Nazi regime. They didn't actually like the Nazis. It's an uneasy alliance in the same way that you see an uneasy alliance with Trump, who does all of the bidding that the Wall Street and the war industry and everybody wants, but he's just so vulgar and distasteful, they'd prefer to get Biden in because he'll do the same thing with a little more decorum. But fascism always takes on the coloring of, this goes back to Italy and Germany, it cloaks itself in the coloring of the national mythology. So with Mussolini, he kept talking about the resurrection of the Roman Empire. He identified with Augustus. With Nazi fascism, it went back to Teutonic myth. And in the United States, it cloaks itself in Christianized white fascism. And I wrote a book, as you know, called American Fascist, The Christian White and the War in America. I did not use the word fascist lightly, and I am a seminary graduate, grew up in the church. These people are heretics. They have used the iconography and language of the Christian religion to essentially sacralize the worst elements of American imperialism, white supremacy, and capitalism. And they're a very powerful, if unseen, force. Because they have created, hermetically sealed, tens of millions of Americans within their world view, which is very much like Trump's world view. And that's why there's such a symbiotic relationship between Trump and the magical thinkers within the Christian right, who continue to support Trump, who don't believe in science, who are, you know, celebrate the Confederacy and the anti-communist witch hunts of the 50s, and Pence. Of course, there are many people around Trump. Trump has an ideological void. It's just narcissism. But there are many people around Trump, Pompeo, Betsy DeVos, Michael Pence, Ben Carson, other who are stalwart members of the Christian right and have very effectively in the last 3.5 years filled that ideological void for Trump with the tenets of this Christian fascism.
Chris, do you think that Joe Biden and the Democratic Party will do much to, in your words, quote, restore the social bonds or address the social inequality of tens of millions of Americans, end quote? Do you have any hope in Biden and the Democratic Party putting forward substantial solutions to the racism and social inequality and other institutional problems that spawned Donald Trump and his followers in the first place?
No, they created it. Biden's statement about how police should shoot people in the legs,
yeah,
I suppose, rather than the head, is that a step forward? He's already said that if Congress passes Medicare for All, he'll veto it. They've already ruled out any kind of a meaningful jobs program, and unemployment is close to 20%. They've fixed the numbers in all sorts of ways and have for many years. I mean, if you work for 1 hour a week in the United States, you're counted as employed. If you stop looking for work, you're no longer on the unemployment rolls. If you're furloughed with no chance of going back to your job, you're not on the unemployment rolls. So real numbers, the LA Times did a story a while ago estimating it was 17%. We don't know, but it's certainly far above 10 or 11%. And then, of course, many of those people are employed. A third of the workforce are living hand-to-mouth, earning minimum wage without benefits. So, no, Biden is a creature of this system. He has built his political career on it. He was a tool of the credit card companies, which are all based in Delaware, including gave his son Hunter a very lucrative job while he was in the Senate. And that's the problem. We're not examining the social, economic, political, cultural decay that has created figures like Trump, given rise to these right-wing proto-fascist militias, which are walking around cities like Portland or Kenosha with automatic weapons, I mean military-grade weapons. And then we are just now seeing the first incipient clashes, the creation of martyrs, which is really really dangerous. I saw the same thing in Yugoslavia. So all of the tinder that is lying about that could ignite widespread violent conflagrations is ominously stacked. You have millions of disenfranchised white Americans who are seething with rage against the ruling elites and a bankrupt liberal elite that presided over this stagnation and social inequality. And you have millions more alienated young men and women who have been completely locked out of the economy. They have no realistic prospect for advancement or integration. And they're gripped by this same emotional void. I mean, their fury is similar against the government structures. It's often expressed through Antifa, this anti-fascism. But what you're creating are these polarized segments, enraged segments of the population, and the political center is, as we watch, disintegrating. I do not consider, by the way, Joe Biden or the Democratic Party to be part of the political center. The Democratic Party under Clinton transformed itself into the Republican Party and pushed the Republican Party so far to the right it became insane.
And it became the white man's party.
Yes, it was always playing, you know, in my book, American Fascists, and I spent 2 years hanging out with these people, I said, you know, all the Republican elites, the Bushes, the Cheneys, the Rumsfeld, they all considered the Christian right to be the useful idiots, but they had the numbers. And I said, you know, you better be careful because the useful idiots one day are going to take over, and that's what happened.
Let's talk about crisis cults. That's what anthropologists call the crisis cults. Would you say that this applies to the Christian right and followers of Donald Trump?
Yes. The Christian right has all of the characteristics of what anthropologists call crisis cults. What are crisis cults? They're when you can't deal, reality is so oppressive, the evictions, the joblessness, the struggle with addictions, the domestic and sexual violence, the inability to free yourself from gambling, alcoholism, opioids, the hopelessness, the fact that you're going nowhere, you know your kids are going nowhere, the stress of poverty or near poverty. These lead people, you know, essentially this is the shutting of all other avenues by which they can actualize themselves. It leads them into the arms of what we call crisis cults. Crisis cults are, and this is what fascism is, it's what communism in its most virulent form was, it's utopian. It severs itself from the reality, fact-based world. It elevates you to a mythological status. Let's say, for instance, you're white. Suddenly you not only deify the white Christian experience in the United States, but the Confederacy, and rewrite history. Somehow the Confederacy is not fought anymore for slavery. It's fought for states' rights, which is ridiculous because all you have to do is read the constitutions of every Confederate state, and they all talk about, almost all of them talk about the primacy of defending slavery. So, and then you just check out. And that was also true with the ethnic nationalists in Yugoslavia. And you can't communicate. You can't have a rational communication with people who think that, you know, Adam and Eve were real and were in the Garden of Eden with the dinosaurs. It doesn't work. But if you push back against these people, you engender a great deal of anger, because what you're really doing is trying to push them back into the rational, fact-based, Cartesian world that almost destroyed them. That's why they're so virulent in terms of their hatred of people who come from that world. And when I finished my book, American Fascists, in the last chapter, I said the only way to blunt this movement, you're not going to argue them out of it. The only way to handle this crisis cult is to reintegrate these people into the society. And that, of course, is what the Democrats and Biden will not do because, of course, they work for Goldman Sachs and Citibank. I mean, indeed, Biden's, I've heard, going to, there's talk about putting Jamie Dimon, who's a criminal, I mean, that's not even disputable, as Treasury Secretary. He's talking to Larry Summers. He's talking to all the old architects of the mess. So, yeah, that crisis cult will grow, and it will grow because the ruling elites have failed to extend the boosting of unemployment benefits, the $600 a month. They have failed to extend the moratorium on foreclosures and bank repossessions, and you see the capitalist class responding. So what are they doing? Well, all the banks are not lending any money. They're hoarding it. Why? Because they know that there's going to be a wave of foreclosures, of bankruptcies, of people unable to pay their credit card debt, their student loans, their car loans, their household debt. They know what's coming. That's why you can't lend any. That's why you can't get any personal loans. I mean, big banks like Wells Fargo don't have publicly said you cannot get loans, and it's because of that. So that will exacerbate these crisis cults because people can have limits. They can only push so far.
Chris Hedges, what do you think about Bernie Sanders supporting Biden instead of leaving the Democratic Party? Do you think he missed his historical moment?
He missed his historical moment in 2016 when hundreds of Sanders delegates walked out carrying Bernie signs, chanting, what does democracy look like? This is what democracy looks like. And Bernie, who desperately wanted to avoid a confrontation with the Clinton campaign, was sending out message after message, which was written by Clinton staffers, calling on people to respect the nomination and be responsible. But, you know, this has always been, I think, Bernie Sanders' fatal flaw. Remember, Sanders has been part of the political establishment for a long time, and he was campaigning on behalf of Bill Clinton in 1996, after Clinton had passed NAFTA, after he'd passed the Omnibus Crime Bill, when it was clear that Clinton had sold out working men and women. He did miss his historical moment. I actually did an event with Bernie the night before the climate march, with Shama Sawant was there, along with Naomi Klein and Bill McKibben. And Shama pushed him and said, you know, you're not going to build a viable alternative within the Democratic Party. You have to step out. We're not going to build it within a particular election cycle. And Bernie's response was, I don't want to end up like Ralph Nader. Now, Sanders isn't wrong that if he had defied the Democratic Party establishment, he would have ended up as a pariah like Nader. They don't target his Senate seat. You know, he runs as an independent in Vermont because he caucuses with the Democratic Party. He has seniority within the party. Schumer's been holding out, you know, committee chairmanships for him if the Democrats retake control of the Senate. And Sanders spent the last 4 years really licking Schumer's boots. I mean, there's kind of these very sad photographs of Sanders and Democratic elites and Sanders off to the side. He was, I think, given this meaningless position of director of outreach. I can't remember what the actual title was. And he thought that it appeared that he thought that if he played the game, they'd give him another shot, and they didn't. I mean, you take away the corporate money from Biden, you take away the corporate money from Clinton, and they're not the nominee. Sanders would have been the nominee. They kept the superdelegates. They could not vote in the first round, but in a convention where nobody gets a plurality, they would have killed Sanders in the second, even if he'd made it. There was no chance. So, and the superdelegates are all lobbyists and, you know, governors and ex-senators, and they're all part of the Democratic Party donor class and hierarchy. So, and they're appointed by the DNC. And you have to be a superdelegate to be on the DNC. So, but I think in the end, Sanders lacked political courage. He, you know, ended up being too much of a careerist, and I think he was always morally as well as temperamentally unfit to lead the kind of fight that needs to be fought.
You've said that in comparison with what lies ahead, this may be the good times. What will things be like if Biden and the Democratic Party replace Trump? I'm thinking about the economy, police, endless wars, military budget, prisons, social inequality, health care, women's rights, racism, echo side that's going on. Let's say that Biden does win. What do you think things will be like?
Well, the internal violence will get worse because, of course, these crisis cults, and Trump functions as a cult figure. He doesn't function as a politician. That's why everybody's reading the opposition to Trump wrong. They're responding to him as if he's a legitimate political figure. The Trump cult leaders, and Margaret Singer, her book, Cults in Our Midst, and those who have written about cults, that great book by Marilu, The Rape of the Mind, and others, they understand that when you are identify with a cult leader, when you feel that you are powerless, you want the cult leader to be omnipotent because that identification with a cult leader it substitutes or gives you the illusion of power. So his followers want him to flout all the rules and lie and flip the middle finger at the establishment. And so sitting up and, you know, day after day listing all his lies, he's impervious to that. It doesn't affect a cult leader. And so the mainstream establishment has never figured out how to deal with Trump. But if Trump loses, I think all the ominous warnings are correct. He isn't going to admit that he lost. He's already stoking violence, inciting violence. That's part of his rhetoric. That will get worse because the ruling elites, Democrat and Republican, have failed to respond to the looming crisis, economic and political, that I just outlined in terms of evictions and, you know, unemployment and everything else. Then, yeah, things are going to get worse. And these wars, which are just hollowing the country out from the inside, aren't going to end. Wholesale surveillance, we're the most watched, spied upon, monitored, eavesdropped, photographed population in human history. And I, as a reporter, covered the Stasi state in East Germany. None of that's going away under Biden. So all of the conditions of corporate tyranny that were implanted in large part by the Democratic Party, and Biden, wasn't just Biden, I mean Obama. I'm very close to Julian Assange and would be in London, but for COVID, was in London sitting in the courtroom at the last hearing. Biden will extradite and torture and lock Assange away, just like Trump. The mechanisms of control that are now in place through militarized police forces, mass incarceration, wholesale surveillance, these systemic problems, there is no daylight between the two parties on these. They walk in lockstep on this. And what that really means is kind of corporate tyranny.
So what do you say to leftists who are urging people to support Biden as the lesser of two evils who can be influenced by the left?
I say they live in a fantasy of their own creation. It's a form of political infantilism. The whole idea that politics is reduced to political personalities. You know, you have to look at people's voting records. They didn't, by the way. Obama's Senate voting record, he's only 2 years in the Senate, was appalling. Was one corporate giveaway after another. That's all the power brokers look at. They understand that the rhetoric is done, you know, for the electorate, and that once power is achieved, the lobbyists will get to work writing all the legislation and running everything. So, I mean, the political America has always been a country, I think, infected with a kind of infantilism, and the left is not immune to that.
Chris, before I have to let you go, tell me, how can people follow your work?
So I don't have any social media, but there is a guy who runs a Twitter account that posts all of my stuff. It's Chris Lynn Hedges on Twitter. That usually gets, you know, whatever the latest article.
Great. I admire what you're doing. I'm so appreciative of your being a guest on Law and Disorder. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Michael.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.